for someone to take over the firm. The estate has the money to hire a lawyer to finish Donovan's business. Frankly, there's no one else in the county that we would even consider. She was holding her breath, fearing a clumsy proposal, hearing a bizarre suggestion. And when he paused, she finally exhaled and said, "Oh boy." "You would work closely with Maddie and Annette, and I'll always be around." It wasn't a complete shock. At least twice, Maddie had vaguely broached the idea of hiring a lawyer to wrap up Donovan's cases. On both occasions, the words sort of hung in the air, but Samantha felt as though they were tossed at her. She said, "I can think of at least 10 reasons why that won't work." "I can think of 11 why it will work," he shot back with a grin. The cheese cart stopped at the table, its pungent aromas and odors engulfing them. Samantha selected 3. Jeff preferred sharp cheddar from the dairy case, but quickly caught on and said he'd take the same ones as Samantha. When the cart rolled away, he said, "You go first. Give me your best reason and I'll match it." "I'm not qualified." "You're smart as hell and you're learning fast. With Maddie's help, you can handle anything. Next." "I might be gone in a few months." "But you can leave when you want to. There's no contract requiring you to return here in 12 months. You said yourself that the legal market is saturated and depressed and there are no jobs. Next." "I'm not a litigator." "Donovan's firm was all about litigation." "You're 29 years old and you can learn anything. Maddie told me you're very quick on your feet and already better than most local yokels in the courtroom." Did she really say that? Would I lie? "Oh, yes. I'm not lying. Next reason." "I've never handled an appeal, much less an appeal with a big verdict." "The lamest one yet. Appeals are all research and paperwork. Piece of cake." "Next." "I'm a city girl, Jeff. Look around you. This is my life. I can't survive in Brady." "Okay, good point. But who says you have to stay there forever? Give it a go for 2 or 3 years. Help us get his cases closed and the fees collected. There's some money out there that I don't want to lose." "Next." "Some of his cases could drag on for years. I can't make that commitment." "Then commit to the Tate appeal. That's 18 months max. It'll fly by and we'll figure out what to do next. Along the way, you can pick and choose other cases that look promising. I'll help. I'm a pretty good ambulance chaser. Next." "I don't want to deal with Donovan's widow." "You won't have to, I promise. Maddie and I will take care of Judy." "Next." She smeared some camembert on a crostini and took a bite. Chewing, she said, "I don't want people following me. I don't like guns." "You can practice law without a gun. Look at Maddie. They're afraid of her. And like I said, I'll be close and I'll protect you." "Next." She swallowed and took a sip of port. "Okay, here's one you can't handle. And there's no way to say it without being blunt. You and Donovan played by different rules. You stole documents in the Kroll mining case, and I'm sure you've cut corners in other cases. I get the feeling that some of the files in that office are, shall we say, contaminated. I want no part of them. The FBI has raided the place once. I'm not going to be there when they raid it again. It's not going to happen. I swear. There's nothing other than Kroll to worry about. And I will not jeopardize you or the office. I promise." "I don't completely trust you." "Thanks. I'll earn your trust. Another bite of cheese, another sip of port. He was eating too, and waiting. He counted with his fingers and said, "That's only 9 reasons, all of which I have just brilliantly shot down." She said, "Okay. Number 10. I'm not sure I would get much work done with you around." "Good point. You want me to keep my hands off?" "I didn't say that. Look at me, Jeff. I'm not in the market for romance, okay? Period. We can fool around all we want, but it's just for fun. The moment things turn serious, then we'll have problems." He smiled and chuckled and said, "So let me get this straight. You want to engage in all manner of sexual behavior, but without the slightest twinge of commitment. Gee, that's a tough one." "It's a deal. You win. Look, Samantha, I'm a 32-year-old bachelor, and I love being single. You need to understand that Donovan and I were scarred when we were very young. Our parents were miserable and couldn't stand the sight of each other. It was a war, and we were the casualties. To us, marriage was a dirty word. There's a reason Donovan and Judy split. Annette said he was quite the tomcat. She should know. I suspected them. For a long time. Who keeps records? And he didn't tell me everything. Donovan was very private, as you know. Did he put the move on you? No. And if he had? It would have been difficult to say no, I'll admit. Very few women said no to Donovan, including Annette. Does Maddie know? He took a sip of port and glanced around the dining room. I doubt it. She doesn't miss much in Brady, but I'm guessing Donovan and Annette were very discreet. If Maddie found out, there would have been complications. She adores Judy and considers Haley a grandchild. The waiter stopped by and she asked for the check. Jeff offered to pay for dinner, but she insisted on treating. "You can buy dinner in Brady," she said. "I'll pay in New York." Not a bad deal. The cheese was gone, and the port was disappearing. For a long time, they sat and listened to the conversations around them, some in different languages. Jeff smiled and said, "Brady is far away, isn't it?" "Indeed it is. Another world. And it's not mine. I gave you 10 reasons, Jeff, and I'm sure I can think of 10 more. I won't be there long. So please, try and understand." "I understand, Samantha. And I don't blame you." Chapter 31. Jeff began the new year with a bang by getting himself arrested at the airport in Charleston, West Virginia. Around 10 p.m., on the first Sunday of the year, a guard strolling through the general aviation area noticed a man attempting to hide in the shadows of a beach bonanza near several other small aircraft. The guard pulled a gun and ordered the man, Jeff, to step away from the airplane. The police were called. They put handcuffs on him and took him to jail. He called Samantha at 6 the following morning, but just for an update. He was not expecting her to come to the rescue, because he had lawyer friends in Charleston. She asked the obvious. "What were you doing snooping around the airport on a Sunday night?" "Investigating," he said. Someone was yelling in the background. She shook her head in frustration at his recklessness. Okay, what can I do? Nothing. It's just trespassing. I'll be out in a few hours. I'll call. Samantha hurried to the office and made the coffee before 7 a.m. She had little time to worry about Jeff and his latest adventure. She reviewed her notes, organized a file, poured a cup of coffee for the road, and at 7:30 took off for Colton, a one-hour drive in which she rehearsed her arguments with the judge and the lawyer for Top Market Solutions. She walked into the Hopper County Courthouse alone. Gone were the days when either Maddie or Annette led interference. She was on her own now, at least for the Booker case. Pamela met her in the hallway and thanked her again. They entered the courtroom and sat at the same table where Donovan Gray had sat with Lisa Tate less than 3 months earlier. The same spot where they had held hands as the jury returned a just verdict. It was not lost on Samantha that in all likelihood, she would be involved in the appeal of that verdict. But not today. Today they were not fighting over anything close to $3 million. $5,000 was more like it. But judging from Samantha's nerves, it could have been millions. The judge called them to order and asked Samantha to proceed. She breathed deeply, looked around, saw that there were no spectators, reminded herself that it was a simple case over a paltry sum, and plowed ahead. She made some brief opening remarks and called Pamela to the witness stand. Pamela described the old credit card judgment, identified the divorce decree, described what it was like to have her paycheck garnished and her job terminated, and did a beautiful job of talking about living with her two children in her car. Samantha produced certified copies of the credit card judgment, the divorce decree, the garnishment order, and payroll records from the lamp factory. After an hour on the stand, Pamela returned to counsel table. Top Market Solutions had a weak defense and an even weaker lawyer. His name was Kipling, a low-end litigator from a two-man firm in Abingdon. And it was obvious Kipling had little enthusiasm for the facts or for his client. He rambled on about how Top Market had been deceived by the credit card company and had acted in good faith. His client had no idea the judgment it was trying to enforce had expired. The judge had no patience with Kipling and his ramblings. He said, "Your motion to dismiss is overruled, Mr. Kipling. Now, let's go off the record." The court reporter relaxed and reached for a coffee cup. The judge said, "I want this matter settled, and now." "Mr. Kipling, it's obvious your client has made a mistake and caused a lot of discomfort to Ms. Booker. We can have a full-blown trial in a month or so, right here, in front of me, no jury, but that would be a waste of time because I've already decided the case. I assure you it will cost your client less now if it agrees to settle."
"Well, sure, Your Honor," Kipling stuttered, on his heels.
It was highly unusual for a trial judge to be so blunt about a future ruling.
"Here's what I think is fair," the judge said. "In other words, here's what my ruling will be. Your client unlawfully garnished Ms. Booker's paychecks, 11 of them, for a total of $1,300. She was kicked out of her trailer because of this. Your client was directly responsible for her getting fired, though I understand she was able to regain her job. Nevertheless, she went through desperate times and ended up homeless and living in her car with her two children, all because of your client. Ms. Booker is entitled to damages for this. She has demanded $5,000 in her lawsuit. But that seems a bit low. If I decided the case today, I would award the $1,300 in lost wages, plus another $10,000 for damages. If I decide the case next month, I assure you this will seem like a bargain. What do you say, Mr. Kipling? Kipling was huddled up with his client, a representative to Top Market, a red-faced little stump of a man in a cheap, tight suit. He was furious and sweating, but he could also grasp what was happening. It was obvious the lawyer and the client did not trust one another. Finally, Kipling said, "Could we have 5 minutes, Your Honor?" "Sure, but only 5. They stomped out of the courtroom. Pamela leaned over and nervously whispered, "I can't believe this." Samantha nodded smugly, as if it were just another day in court. She pretended to be captivated by a document, frowning and underlining some terribly important words, while wanting to yell, "I can't believe it either. This is my first trial." Of course, it really wasn't a trial, but more of a hearing. But it was her first lawsuit, and to win in such a slam dunk fashion was thrilling. The main door opened, and they stomped back to their table. Kipling looked at the judge and said, "Your Honor, well, it looks like my client made some mistakes and is truly sorry for all the trouble it caused. What you suggested is a fair settlement. We'll take it." Samantha floated back to Brady. She thought of Donovan and Jeff after the Tate verdict, floating back to town with a $3 million verdict in their pocket. They could not have been more excited and overwhelmed than Samantha at that moment. She and her colleagues had rescued the Bookers from homelessness, even starvation, and returned them to a normal life. They had pursued justice with determination and found it. The bad guys had been thoroughly routed. As a lawyer, she had never felt so worthy. As a person, she had never felt so needed. Monday's brown bag lunch was spent celebrating Samantha's crushing victory in her first lawsuit. Annette advised her to savor the moment because victories were rare in their business. Maddie cautioned her about celebrating too soon. The check had not yet been received. Once they rehashed the Booker case, the conversation drifted to other matters. Maddie reported that Jeff was out of jail in Charleston. "Did he post a bond or did he escape?" Samantha asked. A prominent lawyer there, one of Donovan's pals, secured his release. No, he did not elaborate on his alleged crime. Annette received an off-the-record call that morning from a clerk in the courthouse, alerting her to the possibility that an unnamed lawyer for the Crump family planned to file a petition to probate the prior will of Francine Crump, one she had signed 5 years earlier, and presumably the one she had shown Samantha. The family was claiming the prior will was valid because Francine had destroyed the later will, the free one prepared by the clinic. It was a looming mess that no one around the table wanted to jump into. Let the Crumps have their land and sell it to a coal company. They didn't care. However, as Maddie explained, as lawyers, they were officers of the court and thereby duty-bound to prevent, if possible, a fraud. They had the original free will, mailed to them by some mysterious person after Francine was felled by a stroke. She had not destroyed it. Indeed, she was hiding it from her children and wanted the clinic to protect it and to probate it. Should they produce the will now and start a war that would rage for several years? Or should they wait and see what the Crumps alleged? There was a good chance the family would continue with its lying about Francine's destruction of the will. If these lies were told under oath and then exposed, there could be serious implications for the family. In all likelihood, they were walking into a trap, one that the clinic could avoid by producing the will now. It was a legal quagmire, a classic law school exam question designed to drive students insane. They decided to wait another week though all three lawyers, along with Claudel and Barb, knew the will should be produced and the family alerted. A heavy snowfall was expected to begin late in the afternoon, and they discussed the office contingencies. Maddie, Annette, and Samantha usually walked to work anyway, so the clinic would be open. Claudel was 8 months pregnant and would not be expected to show up. Barb lived deep in the countryside on a road that was seldom plowed. By 3 p.m., the snow was already falling. Samantha was watching it from her desk, daydreaming and avoiding her files, when the prepaid phone buzzed in her purse. Jeff said he was still in the Charleston area. "How was jail?" she asked. "Be careful what you say," he said. "Oh, right. I forgot." She stood and walked to the front porch. He said he entered the ramp at the general aviation section of the airport by an unlocked gate in a chain-link fence. The small terminal was open, but only a clerk was there. A young girl, sitting at a desk flipping through tabloid magazines. From the shadows, he watched the area for half an hour and saw no movements. In the distance, at the main terminal, there were a few flights, but nothing involving small aircraft. There were 13 airplanes tied down on the ramp, including 4 Skyhawks. 2 were unlocked, and he crawled inside one and sat in the darkness for 10 minutes. In other words, there was virtually no security. He could have tampered with any of the airplanes on the ramp. Then he saw a guard and decided to get arrested. It was only trespassing, a misdemeanor. He'd had more serious charges, he reminded her. The guard was nice, and Jeff turned on the charm. He said he was a pilot and had always dreamed of owning a beach bonanza. He just wanted to see one up close. No harm intended. The guard believed him and was sympathetic, but he had a job to do. Jail was no big deal. The lawyer would take care of things. But while he was chatting up the guard, he asked about other guards who had worked there. Other guys on the ramp who may not be around now. He got one name. A man who quit before Christmas, and he was tracking him down now. She closed her eyes and told him to be careful. She also knew he would spend the rest of his life trying to find the men who killed his brother. The thrill of litigation was tempered somewhat 2 days later when Samantha accompanied Maddie to a black lung hearing before an administrative law judge, ALJ, in the federal courthouse in Charleston. The minor, Wally Landry, was 58 years old and had not worked in 7 years. He was hooked to oxygen and confined to a wheelchair. 14 years earlier, he had filed a claim for black lung benefits based on a doctor's report that he was suffering from complicated black lung disease. The district director of the Department of Labor awarded him benefits. His employer, Braley Resources, appealed to the ALJ, who suggested to Mr. Landry that he find an attorney. Maddie eventually agreed to represent him. They prevailed before the ALJ, and Braley appealed to the Benefits Review Board, BRB, in Washington. The case bounced back and forth between the ALJ and the BRB, for 5 years, before the BRB issued a final ruling in Landry's favor. The company appealed the ruling to the Federal Court of Appeals, where it sat for 2 years before being remanded back to the ALJ. The ALJ requested additional medical evidence, and the experts went to war. Again. Landry had started smoking at the age of 15, quit 20 years later, and as a smoker, got hammered with the usual barrage of medical opinions stating that his lung problems were caused by tar and nicotine and not coal dust. "Anything but coal dust," Maddie said over and over. "That's always their strategy." Maddie had worked on the case for 13 years, had 550 hours invested, and if she ultimately prevailed, would have to fight to get approved at $200 an hour. The fee would be paid by Brayley Resources, an insurance company, whose lawyers charged far more than $200 an hour. On those rare occasions when the clinic collected a fee in a black lung case, the money went into a special account that helped cover the expenses of future black lung cases. As of now, that fund had about $20,000 in it. The hearing took place in a small courtroom. Maddie said it was at least the third time they had all gathered there to rehash the contrasting medical opinions. She and Samantha sat at one table. Not far away, a fashionable gang of sharply dressed lawyers from Casper Slate busily unpacked their thick briefcases and went about their work. Behind Samantha was Wally Landry, shriveled and breathing through a tube in his nose, his wife at his side. When Wally first filed his claim 14 years earlier, he'd been entitled to $641 a month. The legal fees paid by Brayley at that time amounted to at least $600 an hour, according to Maddie's off-the-cuff calculations. "But don't try and make sense of it," she said. The legal fees paid by coal companies and their insurers far exceed the benefits they're fighting to avoid. But that's beside the point. The hurdles and delays discourage other miners from filing claims, and they certainly scare off the lawyers. In the long run, the companies win, as always. A slick Rick in a black suit sauntered over to their table and said, "Well, hello, Maddie. Nice to see you again." Maddie reluctantly got to her feet, offered a limp hand, and said, "Good morning, Trent. Always a pleasure." Trent was about 50 with graying hair and confident looks. His smile was drippy and fake. And when he said, "So sorry about your nephew. Donovan was a fine lawyer," Maddie quickly withdrew her hand and snapped, "Let's not talk about him." "Sorry, of course not. And who is this?" he asked, looking at Samantha. She was on her feet and said, "Samantha Kofer, an intern with the clinic." "Ah, yes, the brilliant investigator who dug through the Reiser records. I'm Trent Fuller." He extended a hand, but Samantha ignored it. "I'm a lawyer, not an investigator," she said. "And I represent Mr. Reiser in his claim for black lung benefits." "Yes, so I've heard." The smile vanished as his eyes narrowed and flashed with hatred. He actually pointed a finger at her as he spoke. "We deeply resent the allegations made against our law firm by your client in his ill-fated lawsuit. Don't make that mistake again. I'm warning you." His voice increased in volume as he lectured her. The other three suits from Castrate froze and glared at her. Samantha was stunned, but there was nowhere to hide. "But you know the allegations are true," she said. He took a step closer, jabbed his finger in her face, and said, "We'll sue you and your client for libel. Do you understand?" Maddie reached forward and gently shoved his hand away. "That's enough, Trent. Go back to your box." He relaxed and offered the same drippy smile. He kept glaring, though, and with a lower voice said to Samantha, "Your client caused us great embarrassment, Ms. Kofer. Even though that lawsuit has been dismissed, it still stings. His black lung claim will get the full treatment in our firm." "Don't they all?" Maddie snapped. "Hell, this one's been on the docket for 14 years and you're still fighting it tooth and nail." "That's what we do, Maddie. That's what we do," he said proudly, backing away and returning to his fan club. "Take a breath," Maddie said as they sat down. I'm not believing this, Samantha said, stunned. I got threatened in open court. Oh, you haven't seen anything yet. They'll threaten you in court, out of court, in the hallways, on the phone, by email, fax, or in court filings. Doesn't matter. They're bullies and brutes, just like their clients. And for the most part, they get away with it. Who is he? One of their more talented assassins. A senior partner. One of six in their Black Lung Division. About 100 associates, dozens of paralegals, and all the support staff they need. Can you imagine Wally Landry sitting here without a lawyer? No. That visual seemed so far-fetched that it had to be illegal. Well, it happens all the time. For a split second, Samantha longed for the strength and security of Scully and Pershing, a firm four times as big as Casper Slate, and far wealthier. No one bullied the litigators at her old firm. Indeed, they were often regarded as the bullies. In a dogfight, they could always send in another pack of wolves to protect their clients. Trent Fuller would never consider such an altercation with lawyers from another big firm. He swaggered over because he saw two women at the table, two ill-paid legal aid lawyers representing, pro bono, a dying minor, and he felt unrestrained in throwing his weight around. The audacity was astonishing. His firm was guilty of fraud and conspiracy and had been caught red-handed by Samantha and exposed when Donovan filed the Reiser lawsuit. Now that the lawsuit was gone, Fuller and his firm were not at all concerned with their own wrongdoing. Of course not. They were worried only about their tarnished image. Nor would Fuller have ventured over and caused trouble had Donovan been there. Indeed, none of the four pretty boys at the other table would risk getting punched because of a stray word or idle threat. They were women, viewed by the boys as easily intimidated and physically vulnerable. They were fighting a losing cause and not getting paid for it. Therefore, they were obviously inferior. Samantha stewed as Maddie shuffled papers. The judge took his place and called things to order. Samantha glanced across the courtroom and again caught Fuller staring at her. He smiled, as if to say, "This is my turf, and you don't belong here." Chapter 32. The email read, "Dear Samantha, I enjoyed our brief meeting in New York and look forward to another conversation with you. Yesterday, January 6th, Kroll Mining filed a motion to dismiss our Hammer Valley lawsuit in federal court in Charleston. This was expected, as was its length and forcefulness. Obviously, Kroll Mining is terrified of the lawsuit and wants to get rid of it. In 35 years, I've never seen a motion as strident in tone, and it will be difficult to counter, absent proof yet to be developed. Can we meet at some point in the near future? Also, no sign of relief from DC. Your friend, Jarrett London." On the one hand, she was hoping Jarrett London was a fading memory. On the other, she had been thinking about him quite a lot since her encounter with Trent Fuller. A trial lawyer with a reputation and courtroom presence would not have been subjected to such a demeaning ambush. Other than her father and Donovan, London was the only trial lawyer she'd met, and none of those three would have tolerated Fuller's antics. Indeed, Fuller, had they been there, would have stayed on his side of the courtroom and said nothing. But she was not eager to meet him. He wanted complicity, and she had no plans to get further involved. The semi-vague proof yet to be developed meant he was desperate and wanted the documents. She wrote back, "Hello, Jarrett. Nice to hear from you. I'm sure I can be available for a meeting. Just let me know when. Washington has been briefed. SK." Washington had not been briefed. Not completely. On the train to Washington after the Christmas holiday, Samantha had told Karen part of the story, and in doing so emphasized the abusive tactics being used by the FBI in harassing the plaintiffs on behalf of Kroll Mining. She said nothing about the hidden documents, nor did she touch on the other dramas currently unfolding in her little part of coal country. Karen seemed interested, to a point, but commented that the FBI was known to overreach and get itself in trouble. From her lofty position at Justice, the agents way down there on the streets were in another world. Karen had no interest in what they were doing, whether in Appalachia or New York or Chicago. Her world these days was consumed with high-level strategies involving policies to be implemented relative to the reckless behavior of certain big banks and certain subprime mortgage lenders, and so on and on. The second significant email of the morning came from a Dr. Draper, a pulmonary specialist in Beckley who'd been selected by the Department of Labor to examine Buddy Reiser. His note was to the point. "Attorney Kofer, attached is my report. Mr. Reiser is suffering from PMF, progressive massive fibrosis, also known as complicated coal workers' pneumoconiosis. His condition is advanced. I understand he is still working. Frankly, I think he should not be, though there is nothing in my report to indicate this. I am available by email for questions. LKD. She was poring over the report when the third one landed. It was from Andy Grubman, but not from his usual Scully and Pershing email address. "Dear Samantha, Happy New Year. I trust this finds you doing well as you hustle about trying to save the world. I miss your smiling face and hope to see you soon. I'll be brief and get right to the point. I have decided to leave Scully and Pershing as of the end of February. I am not being forced out or furloughed or anything like that. We're parting on good terms. The truth is, I can't stand working in tax law. I find it incredibly boring, and I miss my old beat. I have a friend who worked in commercial real estate at another firm for many years, and he's getting squeezed. We have decided to open our own shop, Spain and Grubman, with offices in the financial district. We have lined up two major clients, one a Korean bank, and the other a fund out of Kuwait, and both are poised to pounce on distressed buildings along the East Coast. As you know, there is no shortage of over-leveraged units that have been swept underwater by the recession. Also, these clients think it's the perfect time to start planning construction to begin in a couple of years when the recession is over. They have plenty of cash and are ready to move. Anyway, Nick Spain and I envision a firm of about 20 associates working under the two of us. Compensation will be close to that of big law, and we have no plans to kill ourselves or our associates. We want a nice little boutique firm where the lawyers work hard but also manage to have some fun. I promise the associates will never work more than 80 hours a week. We think 50 is a nice target. The term quality of life is an industry joke, but we're serious about it. I'm tired, and I'm only 41. I'm offering you a position. Isabella's in. Ben has found something else. I'm afraid he's wandered off the reservation. What about it? No pressure, but I need an answer by the end of the month. Needless to say, there are a lot of lawyers out on the streets these days. Your favorite boss, Andy." She read it again, closed her door, and read it for a third time. Andy was basically a nice person from Indiana who'd spent too much time in New York. He sent a thoughtful letter that conveyed a generous and tempting offer, but he simply couldn't help himself, reminding her that there were plenty of lawyers begging for work. She turned off her computer and her office light and sneaked out the back door without being heard. She got into her Ford and was a mile out of town before she asked herself where she might be headed. It didn't matter. January 31st was 24 days away. As she drove, she thought about her clients. Buddy Reiser came first. She had not committed to pushing his case until it was finished, but she had promised Maddie she would file the claim and do the initial heavy lifting. And that was almost a nuisance action compared with the mammoth lawsuit someone should refile against Lone Rock Coal and Casper Slate. There was the brewing mess over the last will of Francine Crump, which, to be honest, was a beautiful reason to immediately call Andy and take the job. There were the Merriweathers, a nice, simple couple who'd sunk their savings into a small home that was now being threatened by a sleazy subprime lender suing for the entire balance. Samantha was seeking an injunction to stop the foreclosure. There were two divorces, still uncontested but unlikely to remain so. Of course, there was the Hammer Valley litigation that wouldn't leave her alone. Frankly, it was another reason to leave. She was helping Maddie with three bankruptcies and two employment discrimination cases. She was still waiting on a check for Pamela Booker, so that file had not been closed. She was helping Annette with two other divorces and Phoebe Fanning's mess. Both Mom and Dad were headed to prison, and no one wanted the kids. To summarize things, Attorney Kofer, you have too many people leaning on you right now to pack up and run. The decision to return to New York was not supposed to be due now, only 3 months into a 12-month furlough. You were supposed to have more time than this. Time to open a few files, help a few folks, keep mildly occupied with one eye on the calendar as the months clicked by, the recession went away, and jobs sprang up all over Manhattan. That was the plan, wasn't it? Perhaps not a return to the drudgery of big law, but surely to a respectable job in something like a boutique firm? A small shop, a few happy lawyers, 50 hours a week, an impressive salary with all the usual goodies. In 2007, her last full year at Scully, she had billed 3,000 hours. The math was easy. 60 billable hours a week for 50 weeks, though she had not been able to enjoy her 2 weeks of paid vacation. To bill 60 hours a week, she had to clock in at least 75, often more. For those lucky enough to enjoy life without staring at a clock, 75 hours a week usually meant, for Samantha anyway, arriving at the office at 8 a.m. and leaving 12 hours later, Monday through Saturday, with a few spillover hours on the Sabbath. And that was normal. Toss in the pressure of a major deadline, one of Andy's clients in crisis, and a 90-hour week was not unusual. And now he was promising only 50? She was in Kentucky, approaching the small town of Whitesburg, an hour from Brady. The roads were clear, but lined with piles of dirty snow. She saw a coffee shop and parked near it. The waitress informed her that there were hot biscuits fresh from the oven. How could one say no? At a table in the front window, she buttered the biscuit and waited for it to cool. She sipped coffee and watched the languid traffic along Main Street. She sent a text to Maddie, said she had to run some errands. She ate a biscuit with strawberry jam and scribbled notes on a pad. She would not say no to Andy's offer, and she wouldn't say yes. She needed time, a few days anyway, to collect her thoughts, analyze them, gather all the information possible, and wait for some phantom voice to tell her what to do. She composed a response she would send later in the afternoon from her desk. The first draft read, "Dear Andy, Happy New Year to you. I must admit I'm shocked by your email and the offer of such a promising position. Frankly, nothing has happened in the past 3 months to prepare me for such a quick return to the city. I thought I had at least a year to contemplate life and my future. Now, though, you've suddenly turned things upside down. I need some time to think this through. I haven't managed to save the world yet, but I'm making progress. My clients are poor people who have no voice. They don't expect me to work miracles, and all efforts are greatly appreciated. I go to court occasionally. Imagine that, Andy. I've actually seen the inside of a courtroom, and it's far different from television. Though, as you know, I didn't have time for television. Last Monday, I won my first trial, $10,000 for my client, and it felt like a million. With some experience, I might learn to enjoy trial work. Now, about your offer. A few specifics. Who are the other associates, and where are they coming from? No assholes, Andy, okay? I'm not working with a bunch of cutthroat gunners. What's the male-female breakdown? No all-boys club. Who is Nick Spain, and what's his story? I'm sure he's a great lawyer, but is he a nice person? Solid marriage or serial bedhopper? If he touches me, I'll sue for harassment, and he needs to know that. Send me his bio, please. Where are the offices? I'm not subjecting myself to miserable working conditions. All I ever wanted was a small office, my office, with a nice window, a little sunlight, and my own wall to hang whatever I choose. This 50-hour-a-week guarantee, will you put that in writing? I'm currently on that schedule, and it is delightful. Who will be the clients, other than the Koreans and Kuwaitis? I'm sure there'll be large corporations and such, or big guys with big egos. Whatever. The point is, I will not be yelled at by a client. My clients here call me Miss Sam and bring me cookies. We can talk about this. Lastly, what's the future? There's not one here, so I won't be staying. I'm a New Yorker, Andy, more so now than 3 months ago. But I would like to know the structure of the new firm and where you and Spain see it 10 years from now. Fair enough? Thanks, Andy, for thinking of me. You were always fair. Not always a sweetheart. But then I'm not sure that's in your DNA. Let's keep talking. Samantha. The temperature was somewhere under 20 degrees, and the snow was frozen and topped with a glaze that reflected moonlight. After a warm dinner with Annette and the kids, Samantha retired to her garage apartment, where the small furnace labored to break the chill. If she were paying a stiff rent in Manhattan, she would have been giving someone an earful, but not in Brady. Not where there was no rent at all, and her landlord was probably low on cash. So she bundled up and read in bed for 2 hours as the time slowly passed. She read a chapter, then put the book down and thought about New York and Andy and his brand new firm. There were so many thoughts running through her mind. There was no doubt she would say yes, and this excited her. The job was perfect. She would return to her home, to the city she loved, and to a job that was prestigious and promising. She could avoid the horrors of big law while pursuing a meaningful career. The bind was in the quitting. She could not simply walk away in a month or so and dump everything on Maddie. No. There had to be a more graceful and equitable exit. She was thinking of a short deferment, an acceptance now, with an arrival on the job in 6 months or so. That would be fair, or as fair as possible. She could sell it to both Maddie and Andy, couldn't she? A phone was buzzing under a pile of clothing. She found it and said, "Yes?" It was Jeff's spy phone, and he responded with, "Are you cold?" She smiled and asked, "Where are you?" "I'm about 40 feet away," hiding in the dark, leaning against the back of the garage, my feet stuck in 8 inches of frozen snow. Can you hear my teeth chattering? I think so. What are you doing here? That should be obvious. Look, Annette just turned off the lights over there, so the coast is clear. I think you should make some coffee, decaf if you have it, and open the damn door. Trust me, no one will see me. The neighbors have been asleep for 2 hours. Once again, all of Brady is dead. She opened the door, and without as much as a squeak, Jeff appeared from the dark stairs and pecked her on the lips. He took off his boots and parked them next to hers. "Staying, are we?" she asked as she poured water into the coffee machine. He rubbed his hands together and said, "I think it's warmer outside. Have you complained to the landlord?" "Haven't thought about it. No rent means no complaints." "Nice to see you out of jail." "You're not going to believe what I've dug up. And that's why you're here, to tell me all about it. Among other things." On the night Donovan died, his Cessna was parked at the Charleston airport for about 7 hours, from 3:20 to 10:31 p.m., according to air traffic control records and data from the General Aviation Terminal. After he landed, he rented a car and took off to meet with his legal team. While he was gone, 4 small planes arrived at the ramp. 2 bought fuel, dropped off a passenger, and left. And the other 2 tied down for the night. One of these was a Beech Baron, the other a King Air 210, a popular twin-engine turboprop that seats 6 passengers. The King Air arrived at 7:35 p.m., with 2 pilots and 1 passenger. All 3 got off the airplane, entered the terminal, did their paperwork, and left with a guy in a van. Samantha listened without a word and poured the decaf. According to Brad, an employee who worked the ramp that night, there were actually 2 passengers on the King Air, one of whom stayed behind. That's right. He spent the night on the airplane. As the 2 pilots were going through their post-flight routines, Brad caught a glimpse of the passenger on the ground, speaking to a passenger still on the plane. From a distance, he watched, and he waited, and sure enough, the pilots closed the King Air's only door. When their aircraft was secure for the night, they walked into the terminal with the passenger, as if all was well. Bizarre, but Brad had actually seen this once before. A couple of years earlier, when a pilot landed late at night, had neither a hotel reservation nor a rental car, and decided to just sleep a few hours in the cockpit and take off at dawn. The difference was that that pilot had made his intentions known, and the ramp guys knew what he was doing. With the King Air, though, only Brad knew what was happening. He kept an eye on the airplane until 10 p.m., when he punched out and went home. 2 days later, he was fired for missing work. He had never liked his job and hated his boss. His brother got him a job in Florida, and he left town. No one had ever interviewed him about the events of that night. Until now, of course. "How'd you find him?" she asked. "The guard who arrested me Sunday night gave me his name. Turns out Mac, the guard, is a pretty great guy. We had beers late Monday night, me buying, of course, and Mac gave me the dirt on Brad. Brad's back in Charleston now. I found him last night, and in another bar, we had some drinks. I'm detoxing tonight, so don't offer me anything. There's not a drop in the house." "Good. So your theory is?" "My theory is that this mysterious passenger waited until the right moment, opened the door of the King Air, walked about 30 yards in the darkness, straight to Donovan's Cessna, and in about 20 minutes, loosened the B-nut. Then he backtracked, climbed into the King Air, and was probably watching when Donovan showed up around 10:15 for his departure. After that, he kicked off his shoes and slept until sunrise. Sounds impossible to prove. Maybe, but I'm getting there. Who owns the King Air? A charter service out of York, Pennsylvania. A company that does a lot of business with coal companies. The King Air is the workhorse in the coal fields because it's durable, has a nice payload, and works off short runways. This company has 4 available for charter. There are plenty of records, so we'll soon know everything about the flight. Brad says he'll give an affidavit, though I'm a little worried about him. This is incredible, Jeff. It's huge. The investigators will grill the owners of the plane, the pilots, the passenger or passengers, and whoever chartered it for the trip. We're getting closer, Samantha. It's an unbelievable break. Nice work, Sherlock. Sometimes you just gotta get yourself arrested. You have an extra quilt somewhere around here? They're all layered up on the bed. That's where I was, reading. Was that a pickup line? We're already picked up, Jeff. The question at the moment is sex. And I hate to tell you, it's not going to happen. Not the best time of the month. Oh, sorry. You could have called. I guess. Then why don't we just cuddle and share body heat and sleep together? I mean, you know, actually sleep. I suppose that will work. Chapter 33. She had no idea what time he left. When she awoke, a few streaks of morning light penetrated the blinds and windows. It was almost 6 a.m. His side of the bed was not warm, as if he'd been gone for hours. Whatever. He lived in the shadows and left few trails, and that was fine with her. He carried burdens and baggage she would never understand, so why bother? She thought about him for a few moments as she peeked from under the quilts and watched damp clouds follow her breathing. It was cold out there, and she had to admit she longed for his warmth. She also longed for a hot shower, but that would not be happening. She counted to 10, threw off the covers, and raced to the coffee pot. It took forever to brew, and when she finally had a cup, she crawled back under the covers and thought about New York. Her plans were to polish up her response to Andy and email it first thing. Was it too pushy? Too demanding? She was, after all, unemployed, and he was offering a wonderful job. Did she have the right to nag about her associates and clients? About Mr. Nick Spain and the dimensions of her new office? Would her deferment scheme please Andy or irritate him? She wasn't sure, but Andy had a thick skin. If she didn't assert herself in the beginning, she would certainly get run over later. She skipped the cold shower and did a bird bath with lukewarm water in the sink. With no court appointments on the calendar, she dressed quickly in jeans and boots, flannel shirt, and sweater. When she was properly bundled, she looped her satchel over one shoulder, her purse over the other, and left for work on foot. The air was crisp and still, the sun brilliant as it rose. It was a beautiful winter day, with snow still untouched in thick drifts against the houses. Not a bad way to get to work, she thought, as she walked through Brady. On the negative side, in New York, she would be packed into a subway train, then jostling through heavy foot traffic, or perhaps sitting in the back of a dirty cab, waiting in traffic. She spoke to Mr. Gantry as he fetched his newspaper off the sidewalk. He was pushing 90, lived alone since his wife died last year, and in warmer weather had the prettiest lawn on the street. All snow on his property had been meticulously scraped and shoveled. As usual these days, she arrived first at the office, and, as the intern, went straight to the coffee pot. As it brewed, she tidied up the kitchen, emptied all the waste baskets throughout the place, and straightened magazines in the reception area. No one had ever told her to do these things. On the positive side, in New York, Spain and Grubman would pay someone else to do such chores. On the neutral side, Samantha really didn't mind doing them. Not here, anyway. She wouldn't dare do them at a real firm. But at the Mountain Legal Aid Clinic, everyone pitched in. She sat in the conference room and watched the early traffic on Main Street. Now that she was planning to leave, she was astonished at how fond of the place she had become in 3 short months. She decided she would postpone the discussion with Maddie and wait until she knew more about Andy's offer. The thought of telling her she was leaving so soon was unsettling. Maddie's mornings were still slower, but she seemed to be finding her old self. Donovan's absence was a jagged wound that would never heal, but she couldn't stop living. She had too many clients who needed her, too many entries in her calendar. She rolled in just after 9 and asked Samantha to step into her office. With the door closed, she explained that she'd lost sleep the night before worrying about those wretched Crump people and poor old dead Francine. The only ethical thing to do was to poll the local bar and see if anyone had been hired by the family. If so, they would zip over a copy of the will and start the war. Maddie handed over a list and said, "Not including us, there are 14 lawyers in Brady, all alphabetized with phone numbers. I've already talked to 3, including Jackie Spores, the lawyer who did the will 5 years ago. None has heard from the family. You pick 5 and let's get it done this morning. I'm tired of worrying about it." Samantha had met all but 2. She went to her office, grabbed the phone, and called Hump. He said no, he'd never heard of the Crumps. Lucky for him. The second call was to Hayes Sinclair, a lawyer who never came out of his office and was rumored to be suffering from agoraphobia. No, he had never heard of the Crumps. The third call was to Lee Chatham, a lawyer who never stayed in his office, but was always hanging around the courthouse, posturing as if he had important business there and trafficking in gossip, most of which he created. Bingo. Mr. Chatham said yes, he had met with several of the Crumps and had a contract to represent the family. Evidently, they were pressing ahead with their fiction that their mother destroyed the free will prepared by those crooks over at Legal Aid, and therefore things would revert back to the prior will, which split everything equally. Mr. Chatham's plans were to open the estate in the near future,